This is a production of Cornell University.
I would like to call the meeting to order. Thank you everybody for being here for the emergency meeting. And thank you for our tech for being with us too. So today we'll start again as usual with roll call of voting members. Arts and Humanities, Kristen, Jesse.
I'm here and I would like to get any vegan food.
Becca. Life Sciences, Tyler.
Here.
Elena.
Here.
Cassandra.
Here.
Physical Sciences and Engineering, Ariana.
Here.
Sarah.
Here.
Alex.
Here.
Zanda.
Here.
Professional Schools, Rachel.
Here.
Jonathan.
Here.
Cheyenne.
Here.
Social Sciences, Margaret.
Here.
Carol Rose. Dan. Wendy. Masters, Ranisa. So we have 14 members and we have four. Yeah. Next on the agenda is approval of the minutes. Tyler?
I'd like to make a change. It's on page four. It's a relatively small change. And it's under section 5D. I want the date in the parentheses to state 11/10, not 11/3. It's for the next appropriations meeting.
Is there a second? Second. Is there dissent? Seeing none, the date has been amended to 11/10. Matt?
Just a quiet. Amendment for Michael Meyer marks are noted as on page two of the minutes. It states right now, I'm excited, what can we do for health and professional schools lower tuition? The question I had said was, what can we do to help increase disability professional schools? Lower tuition isn't part of that, but to add the increasing disability to ensure that the notes reflect the actual acceptance of the question.
What can we do for helping professional schools increase accessibility?
Correct.
Okay. Any second?
Second.
Any dissent? Seeing none, so amended. Any other amendments?
Motion to call the question?
Second.
Any dissent? Any dissent to approving the minutes? Seeing none, the minutes are approved. And we'll go on to presentations for today. First up, we have Christina Kim from the Office of the Complainants Advisors. You have the floor.
You want us to speak here? People in the back, can you hear me? Okay, great. So I'm Christina.
And I'm Margie.
And we are here on behalf of the Office of the Complainants Advisors. We are law students hired by the university to guide students through Cornell's internal process, Policy 6.4, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. Policy 6.4 deals with bias, discrimination, harassment, and sexual misconduct. And Gargi is going to walk us through the pertinent aspects of the latest campus climate survey as it pertains to grad students.
Sure, so I don't know if you guys saw the most recent campus climate survey, but 48% of women who are graduate students have reported some sort of contact with sexual harassment or bias. And 34% of men have as well. Additionally, the campus climate survey shows relatively less understanding of the procedures available to you if you have experienced something like this. A lot of people know about the health services available through Cornell Health, but not as many people know about the Title IX office, about our office, about the judicial code counselor, and kind of the procedural things that happen when it comes to disciplinary measures for sexual harassment, bias, et cetera. Claims like that. So that's one of the reasons why we've been going around and trying to speak to people about what exactly our office does and how you can promote our resources to people that might need them.
Sure, and we know that this year in particular was crazy with a host of incidences occurring on campus and nationwide. However, we believe that this sexual assault and sexual misconduct has been an issue prevalent both in Cornell and the wider college campus community on a nationwide scale. And for grad students, we work closely with Nina from Victims Advocate, and she told us that there has been a spike in numbers of graduate students coming in to speak with her as it pertains to Title IX and filing a complaint. And so with grad students, there is a degree of independence in how you study and the remoteness from campus, but I think at times there can be a disconnect with the resources available. So Guardian and I wanted to introduce our office and to create awareness and promote what we do and a type of resource available that many students aren't familiar with.
So what we do is we provide procedural advocacy, which means that if there is someone that is interested in learning more about what they can do as a complainant for a Policy 6-4 claim, they can come to our office. So this, the complainant is the person that files a complaint against someone else alleging sexual harassment or bias or assault. They can come to our office before talking to the government at all and discussing with us their options. There are a number of options, including a formal complaint process, which involves a hearing, involves collecting evidence, involves interviews with the Title IX coordinator, et cetera. There's less formalized processes, like an alternate resolution process, where there might be a meeting of the minds between the complainant and the respondent as to what punishment the two are, or disciplinary measures the two are okay with. There are things like no contact orders. There are ways to enforce no contact orders. Our office also governs violations of no contact orders if the no contact order has already been in place. So we kind of sit down and help walk the complainant through their options. What's important about us is that we do not have a duty to report. So if someone wants to talk to someone that knows the process, that knows how it works, but not a faculty member who might have a duty to report, not an RA who also has duties to report, they can come to us and just get, you know, confidential, free advice. We are a procedural advocate. We're not there for emotional support, but we have a close relationship with the Victims Advocacy Center that often provides that kind of support as well. And so members of our office receive training biannually, and of course we have training as it pertains to speaking with clients, dealing with trauma, dealing with sensitive information, and although a lot of the resources on campus intersect, we can be a touch place for complainants. Should they need emotional counseling, we can connect them to Nina. Should they want to alert CUPD, we also have contacts there. And of course, if they want to file a formal complaint, then we are procedural advocates, and we have many cases. We have seen through many cases. And to give you the statistics, from August 1st until now, 18 complainants have reached out to us, and from there, 10 have filed a formal complaint. And so, the whole reason why our office exists is, of course, to help with the procedural aspect of a complaint, but also to ensure that students make an informed decision, that they know what the policy is about, what their rights are, and that's primarily why we do it. Another important thing that I want to put out there is we provide a lot of writing services frequently, writing the actual comments on the evidence, being prepared for a hearing, writing closing statements, an opening statement. This is one of the most daunting processes, especially for undergraduate students who might not have a lot of experience writing. But even for graduate students who are not familiar with the adversarial process, it might still be quite daunting. So the biggest thing that we do is help write those comments and write those opening and closing statements for our community.
And on a closing note, we have noticed that from the grad students who come forward and speak with us, they generally sometimes involve faculty. It could be harassment in the workplace on the basis of sex, sexual harassment of any kind. So we understand that grad students, the types of cases and experiences that you guys go through is different from what we see in the undergrad pool, but we have seen graduate students come reach out to us, and because this is a prevalent issue both on the undergrad and graduate level, we wanted to come speak with you guys, and hopefully then you guys will carry the message on to your respective communities. We brought some materials that are in the front, so please take one and pass it along to your friends and people in your graduate program.
And our email address is complaintadvice@cornell.edu. So anyone is feel free to email that email with as few or as many facts about their situation as they want to. And we pair them up with one of our complainant advisors and get the conversation started. Right now, there are
You guys have any questions or comments?
I have started a name list, and I have Matt's name. So if you want to ask any questions, you can raise your hand on record, and then I'll call on you. So we'll start with Matt, and then Manish.
First off, thank you very much, not only for the presentation, but also for your service in the Cornell community. You provide an invaluable service to people who unfortunately have been subject to sometimes horrible or horrific instances of aggression and violence. I'm just curious in terms of, you mentioned you had 18 cases since the start of the semester. In terms of, you said there's five people in your office. Do you feel like you're adequately resourced? Is this something that can help with in terms of advocating for more funding in terms of resources, more resources in terms of manpower, or just in terms of, in essence, do you feel you have the resources to do your job? I know it's probably a busy time, but is there anything you can help with that area?
Sure, thanks for your question. So Vardy, why don't you kind of jump in whenever. In terms of the woman power in our office, we do have one male complainants advisor. And in terms of how the next advisor is selected, it's a fairly rigorous process. There are many steps in the application process. Vardy and I have both been heavily invested in it, where we ask tailored questions. There are scenarios where we see how the advisor would deal with sensitive information. So in terms of selecting applicants, we do it from the law school. And to that end, we feel like that is pretty good, I think, in terms of the amount of advisors we have. You want to speak about the resources?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we are fine for now. We will have an office at the law school once construction finishes. Right now, just a lot of parts of the building are blocked off. I think, you know, one of our concerns, or at least my concern, is maybe once we, you know, spread awareness and things become a little more, people know about our office more, we might get more cases coming in. We've noticed even this year we've had a lot more attention than last year. Also, last year was the first year that we ever existed. So as we continue to establish a bit of a base, we might need some more compliance advisors, but I think for now we're good.
And in terms of how we engage with the complainants, we have complainants who have graduated, but the respondent is still a student, so we would have to either Skype or ring phone call, and Vardy has experience on that matter. So as we receive more complainants who have different circumstances, we realize that there may be technical aspects that we need to address, but as of right now, I think we are holding the fort down.
Manisha? Thank you guys so much for coming. I just want to just reiterate Matt's point. My question is regarding the five members in your office. Are they paid staffers, or is it like a credit-based system for the law school that is how they're being compensated for the work that they're being done, that they're doing? We get paid at an hourly rate, and we're all at law school. Is that paid by the law school? By the university.
Next, I have Jesse.
That was my question.
Okay. And I have Alex.
Alright, so this question might be a little more broad to answer, but in light of the recent new regulations, or what we think are regulations from the Trump administration regarding the Dear Colleague letter, do you have opinions on whether the current process is working, or if there is a shift in the process, or how is it from your perspective?
Sure, I actually do think that Cornell Title IX office is pretty fair and good at their job. I think one of the problems is that they are a little understaffed, and there are a lot of cases going on, a lot of things going on that, you know, I'm sure not even we are aware of, that seems to slow down the investigative process for a lot of cases. So one of the things that we struggle with is that our complainants just wait and wait and wait for a really long time without knowing when the record is going to come out, when their hearing is going to be scheduled, if they're going to be further delayed. I think that's the biggest thing that we deal with.
And to address a specific part of your question as it pertains to the evidentiary standard, until the university releases a statement, we are going to operate under what was the evidentiary standard, which is preponderance. And our office, we try not to take a political position. So when local reporters or reporters from the Sun reach out to us, which they have, to ask for our feedback, we try to parse the line between staying away from being political, yet advocating on behalf of our clients to the best that we can. And that is to fight for the standard that we believe is fair and effective. I'm not sure if that answers.
No, that answers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you. So you, I guess the office would also be responsible for cases that take place in both Geneva and Cornell Tech, and we have graduate professional students at both of those locations. Is there a way for them to get in contact with your office? Have you been able to reach those students?
Sure. So I have received a case where the complainant was at Weill Medical School, and it does get a bit tricky because they have a different policy that they work under. But generally, we find that Skype and phone, while it's not ideal, it does work. And we do try a lot of times so that we're uninterrupted. So it almost feels like we're actually meeting face to face. In terms of our outreach, we haven't gotten to the satellite campuses, but because you brought it up, it's something that we definitely look into. It's important. But as of right now, we find that trying to raise awareness in the Ithaca campus has been a priority for us. But we certainly do take cases from the satellite campus. Great. Thank you so much for coming. Next on the agenda is Jada from the GPSA NAPC.
Hi, I'm Peja. I'm a fifth year grad student in neurologic behavior. I'm the current chair of the GPSA NAPC Commission. I know there may be a lot of questions, so I have a very, very, very short presentation, which I think will cover most of them. The first asked question. Okay. So if you already know this, of course, apologies for that. So what is the GPSNC? In case you guys don't know this yet, we're a standing committee with charge with allocating funds to graduate professional student organizations. There are about 302 currently registered judge and professional student organizations on campus who is on the GPSAFC, so who gets to make these decisions. Typically, it's the chair elected by the GPSA, and the chair serves one term, January to January, so my term is coming to an end soon. And we are typically staffed by current graduate and commission students, we call them commissioners. The committee membership is the only committee which has a cap membership. The reason I'm talking about this is typically we get questions like who's on the FC, is it university staffers, so it's all graduate professional students who are currently enrolled. Where's the money coming from? I know Tyler's going to probably talk a lot about this later, but there's a mandate in our, I think, charter, I'm not sure, which basically says that 35% of the GPSA student activity fee has to go towards the GPSA Finance Commission. And that's currently right now about $29,000. Okay. How often do we meet? We meet once a month during the academic year, and we have 9 regular meetings. We have one annual 6-hour marathon in May where we go through as many budgets as we possibly can for the next year. And typically, we get, you know, we only take breaks for toilet and drinks. It's kind of intense, guys. When do these meetings typically happen? The long review sessions, we meet once a week. Typically for 3 hours, we go about from like 5 to 8 or 6 to 9. Usually we get Thai food. And each budget is independently reviewed by 2 different commissioners. If there are new commissioners, we review it one by an experienced commissioner and one newbie so that they get on board pretty quickly. And then I finally review it to make sure there aren't any breaches of mistakes. Then what have we been up to? So we typically review budgets once a month, and we're following up with reallocation requests. So I know that we spoke a lot about, what are the new guidelines being in? How is that going to affect you? So a lot of old student boards allocated or asked for an allocation for their entire money for the next year, and then the new board comes in and they're like, this is not what we want to do. And then they are requesting reallocations. And that's a little bit of a tricky financial, move to do. So basically, we have to go in and then we have to. There's a lot of paper that needs to be moved around to make sure they can use their money for this session. So typically, we're getting about 120 to 140 budgets per review session. So far, we've hit about, I think, 400 budgets so far this year. To give you a bit of context, last entire spring semester, we had 100. Four times the number of budgets in half the amount of time. So this is basically taking all of our attention span, basically. Okay. But we think it's a good thing
Because what that means is that I think because of all the noise that we caused by having these new guidelines and making sure groups are aware that they can ask for money, we are getting a lot more groups asking for money. And is that a good thing? Okay. We'll find out. So what does financials look like? So this is sort of the problem we were trying to address, and hopefully we will address it. So we had $150,000 rollover from last year, which means almost your entire budget came back to us. And this usually comes from groups either not utilizing the funds, and there are of course many reasons for that. It might be because they did not apply for reimbursements, or were so upset with the reimbursement process that decided to just pay our money. So currently we have allocated about I'll just leave one gap left. We have about $184,000 left in our allocation. Which is a good sign. Typically, in previous years, about this time, we are left with about $20,000. So because of the new guidelines and because of the caps, groups are asking for exactly the amount of money they intend to spend, because the penalties for not doing so are pretty high. And that means that we still have a large amount of money that we can allocate when groups decide to have that events right now. In previous years, if you hadn't already decided or applied for a budget by this time, it was very unlikely that you were going to get any money to do it. So we think so far the process is working, both because people are asking for on a very subjective basis, the quality of budgets and the information on each of these budgets has gone up dramatically. For a while now, you can tell them. It's like student grades, you know, when you give someone like a 2, the next assignment just looks so much better. So who do you contact to get more information on the budget process if you get stuck? Me. How often can you expect a response? Typically a week, because on average I get about 10 emails telling me that I'm doing terrible things and I'm ruining their student organization and I'm a capitalist fascist thing. But I would like to make it very clear that I'm not of those things. But really, the objective here is to give student groups access to money as easily as possible. Make sure that they have the ability to spend the student activity fee while making sure that this money is not just sitting in an account unused. So to speak to that, so far, if you've sent us a budget, if that budget has met our guidelines, as in your advisor signed off, the budget was within bounds, we have funded those 100%. If your budget comes in, you ask for, and it follows guidelines, you get 100% of what you ask for. We aren't doing the thing where you ask for 100 and we give you 70, and then you get clever, and then you ask for 200 next time, so you get 140. And so it isn't this thing where you're asking for eventually like a runaway process where you're asking for $7,000 in the budget and we give you like $90. So that is not what is happening. Both the ask and the response is on par. And based on at least what we can see, how groups are spending their money, it seems to be the new guidelines seem to be doing their job. There are, of course, a lot of problems and loopholes that we did not anticipate. And hopefully, before my term ends, or maybe the next term, I can propose a set of amendments to fix those batch new guidelines. All right. Questions?
Mate.
Awesome. Thanks, Tanja. So there's kind of, I see it's like two parts of being part of the budget process. Mm-hmm. There's the allocation process and there's the reimbursement process. And I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about what role the GPSAFC plays in the reimbursement process and helping people do that.
So one thing I left out here, which I didn't say, is that the GPSAFC is primarily responsible for allocating your budget, which is you ask for money, we look at your events, and we say, okay, these make sense. You're not throwing yourself steak dinners and getting yourself cocktails, that's great. This is the right thing to do, and we usually fund it. The second part of the process is the reimbursement, which is after you've spent your money, you go get it reimbursed. GPSAFC does not have any authority on the reimbursement side. That is handled by the, I'm not even sure, what there are like four offices involved, but which is basically the problem. So there's a form you fill out with all the receipts and everything that you spent, and you submit that form to Marie Roller, who's under the Dean of Students in the Campus Activities Office, and also a part of the financial like budgeting office who interfaces with us. And when she gets this, she makes sure that your receipts make sense. You didn't spend it on things that you didn't say that you were going to spend it on. So if, for example, in a budget you ask money for a specific event, you're required to spend that money on that event or an event something like it. You can't spend it on, say you can't ask for money for a speaker and then throw yourself a field party and get pizza. That's not allowed. So Marie's job is to make sure that the receipts and the form line up and that you get reimbursed. There are delays in this process. It's a paper process. The only time that I get to hear about it being a problem is if the two events don't match up, or if the group does something off campus, which you're not supposed to do, or the group forgot to advertise, which groups are required to do. And then Marie says to me, like, this group did not advertise, do we still go ahead and reimburse them or not? So far, I have not turned down anyone, even if there have been made, you know, even if they've obviously flouted the rules as they are. Usually I use it as a teaching experience. I'm like, okay, don't do this again. These are the rules. This is where you can find the rules. Please follow the rules. But yeah, so in terms of the reimbursement process, that's the part that we're, yeah.
Alex. My question relates to the commissioners. Are they also on January term?
No. So the commissioners are elected, well, not to be elected, appointed on a standard mid-term. Like academic year. There are no commissioners during the summer. So one of the reasons to have the January term is because we do give out summer budgets, and those allocations basically come down to the commissioner making sure the loan commissioner left, which is the chair, making sure that the groups are following the guidelines, and if they are, yeah.
I guess I have two questions. One, and this is based on what you just said, have you considered having people around, having a second or third? I mean, in terms of, it seems that it's a lot of work to put on just yours or the chairs. I mean, you're doing great work, I'm sure you're working very hard, but it seems like the summer, this is, you're piling work on you. Like, there's someone around who's just considering that flexibility with it.
Yeah, actually, you'd be surprised if we get like 20 summer budgets. It's not much at all. A lot of groups do not ask for summer funding because they're usually not either here or they didn't have an annual budget to start with. So there's like so we don't actually get a lot of people asking for summer money. But yeah, do you think you have a second question?
The question I actually had was, I know looking at the way the law school does this, mm-hmm. We have, in essence, somebody's talking. One woman named Linda, she, in essence, for law school student groups, we were funded through the GPSAFC. But we got our funding, we submit a form to her, and then she handled all the food and mm-hmm. reimbursements handled through law school. Mm-hmm. I know that's difficult to do on a macro scale, but have you explored or have you even considered if that could be done either further out to try and minimize the amount of reimbursements? I'm just saying, because university hates reimbursements because they're a Medicare for them too. So that's just a way to make it so there's a way to direct order certain common things to pizza, Thai food, et cetera.
So to address that, so there's one thing that is not well known, and I'm trying to find a better way to make this known, is that you don't actually have to spend your own money to start. You can go to Marie Droller, who is the person who you will eventually give reimbursements to, and ask for Wegmans cards or direct orders or whatever. So you don't actually have to front the money. You can go and point out that, hey, I'm from this organization, we were allocated X amount of money, this is what we intend to spend it on, could you order it for me directly? So that can be done. So the problem with, so the professional schools have a full-time staffer, this is what Matt talked about, have full-time staffers whose only job, one of their jobs is to reimburse student organizations. So they sort of act as a midway between the finance commission and student groups. So the law school pays the student groups to do what they need to do, and then handles all the financial allocation documents on their behalf with the finance commission. With the campus activities office today. That's a little bit of a workaround, I don't know if other groups can you know pay for a full time staff to do that.
Rachel,
hi.
I have a question. But how often are GPSAFC guidelines reviewed? And have you thought about conducting a formal survey going out
how this is done, because within Johnson, the business school, I have received a lot of negative complaints and they're all coming towards me, and I think read a lot of ill will where the teachers are trying to reach out to people, but all they hear is how much trouble they're having with each kid lately, and I really think it would be, I mean, this all sounds great, but I can underline that there are a lot of issues that they
Yeah, this is good. You're talking about allocations on the Johnson School side, yes?
I'm talking about what you have to reimburse.
Yeah, the allocations, that's right. Right. Yeah, so we have had a lot of trouble with specifically Johnson Schools in the first 2 months. And so the staff are dealing with the Johnson Schools is around that. So one of the biggest problems we've had so far are, I'll just go in order of questions. FC guidelines are very infrequently reviewed. The last time we did it was, of course, last year. Before that, I think it was like 10, 15 years ago. So they don't actually get looked at that often. But because these are new, and obviously there are things that are not quite working for everyone as well, I do intend to propose an amendment fixing all these loopholes. So that's the first question. Two, have we asked for surveys? So when we set up the GPSAFC guidelines, reviews, and revisions, we had a town hall. No, we have not. So since the implementation of guidelines, no, we have not had an official survey gone. It's been 3 months since the, 2 months? 2-3 months since the guidelines have been in effect, technically. So no, we have not had an official survey going on. Third. Yes, the most amount of problems we are having in terms of professional school problems, has been from the Johnson School. A lot of that has had to do with previous interpretations and what really was there and what it was thought was there. So one big problem was the idea of like a social funding. So nowhere in the guidelines, even the previous guidelines, has it ever said that social funds are restricted to individual groups or individual fields and they're not required to advertise. But for some reason, it was thought that social meant that it could be restricted to a particular group. And that caused some, did you advertise it? Did you not advertise it? Can we refund you if you haven't advertised it? All of that. So that was one. And then the second one was organizations requiring to be registered when they apply for budgets. So we cannot give out money to organizations that are not registered, right? So what do I mean by registered? Each organization needs to be registered with the campus activities office. The registration usually means updating of their constitution, updating of the officers on the for the organization, and officers and advisor. And if all those three things have been done, then submitting a budget which reflects when the event is going to happen and reflects the current time. So most of the problems, at least from the first month, and this was because of the registration process. Most of the organizations who were applying were not registered for that. Now what that meant was that we did not know who the officers were who were applying. The officers who were applying for the budget were not the same as the officers listed on the organization page. And what we have done is that I realized that this was a problem that month. So what we sent for September and October was we said that even if you're not registered, we will review the budget for this one cycle, but you're required to have that registration in order to spend your budget or not.
So I appreciate that, and I think those aren't even the issues I was speaking to, but I just want to raise it again with the feedback to the change, because I think it's happening here and not even for those reasons, it might be occurring in other schools, and it's just valuable to review the process. Like, I appreciate that, but those are like reminders of what's going wrong. But I think it'd be valuable to review how the guidelines roll out as a working process.
Yeah, I mean, after, or if you can send me an email about the problems there are. And we'll walk forward.
Next time, send that.
Hi.
Okay,
one very quickly, and maybe I just misunderstood this before. When you say funds not yet allocated, does that include rollover?
No, sorry. This is what we got last year. This is what we got as activity fee. And this is what we haven't yet allocated.
Across.
Yeah, across. This is the total amount of money we got.
All right, great.
So we get like 300 plus something, and that's all.
All right. And then the second question is regarding organizations where, and this is not my organization, this is just something I've heard about. Regarding organizations where they submitted something, they got a response back that was negative, and they think there might have been a misunderstanding. What is the right way to appeal that?
Okay, so there's a...
So they submitted an event or, event budget, they explained things, but they think they must have like explained something incorrectly, they didn't get it.
So we review things once every month. So say you submitted a budget, and then we read through it, and the commissioner was like, oh, this doesn't, whatever the two commissioners who reviewed it, both agreed that this doesn't make sense, or this is incorrect. They'll usually leave a comment on the budget saying that, hey, this is what you think the problem is. And then we move the budget into the next review cycle. So we look at it again, well, in the next event. So by the time we, so there are many ways to sort of address this problem. So if there is something incorrectly filed or not, or the details of the event weren't clear, you can just write a comment saying, these are the event details, this is how we change it, this is how we fix it.
And then you resubmit.
Yeah, you don't even have to resubmit, you just leave a comment because we want it, unless it's been actively denied. If you just leave a comment, it's still pending in our system. But unless it is something of the order where you're supposed to request funds from the program funding, or but you instead ask everything from like GDCI funding, which is supposed to be a top up, not a source in itself. And all of your, then we can't approve that, then we can't review that budget here to submit anymore.
Great.
Next,
I
have
Anthony.
Just a couple questions. In your previous discussion about the issues that you face with the Johnson School, it sounded like a lot of very similar situations that the work that I'm affiliated with was also faced. Is there anything you guys have done or considered doing in terms of advertising the requirements or on the policy you have so that you head off sort of these issues? A lot of the organizations are new and unfamiliar with this
policy. Yeah, no, that's definitely one thing I do take responsibility for, is that we have not kept a pace with our recognition campaign. Typically, and this is really leads to, or circles back to the number of budgets we've had to deal with. So typically, even in like a fall semester, we used to get about 100 budgets total. And that left time to hold information sessions and workshops, usually invite all the treasurers, send out a digital email, and basically give this kind of session for an hour and then take questions from veterans and then ask, okay, what do you not know how to do, which organization you have to do. And this is definitely my fault, because we haven't been able to do all our budgets and have the ability to know this workshop. So.
All right, so then I guess a follow-up question, is there any way that GPSA as a whole can allocate you additional resources?
I think you're very well funded. It really comes down to people willing to do the work. We have a full committee, and most of this is by mandate because tier four organizations are required to send definite tickets, and they're required to show up to these meetings and evaluate budgets. But even though we have a full committee which shows up regularly, I don't yet have a committee for chair for next. I don't have a candidate for chair for next time. So it really comes down to who's willing to shoulder all the responsibility of both being at the receiving end of not getting requested emails. And I think it really is find the place that somebody's going to take
it. Is there a reason why your committee is capped at 10 members?
I'm actually not entirely sure why. But my guess is because both on individual budgets are, I mean, it's an actual vote. Like, people have to agree that this is a sufficient amount of money to give to this particular organization. If you're not capped, you can keep growing out of the committee so that people can just come in and be a part of a vote. I think that was the idea, but I'm not entirely sure why it's capped.
I have a second question. Similarly, I'm involved in games earlier. To what degree does GPSAFC or the GPSA in general have power
control
over the reimbursement process, and why?
Okay, I don't know about the why part. I can tell you what degree of control that we have. The degree of control is, do we reimburse an organization even if the guidelines were not followed? The question usually comes to the chair. That usually comes to the chair. So when it comes to that point, the FC chair can then ask the committee, this is what happened. This is what the organization did. This is obviously a violation of this, but nobody was trying to, you know, run away with like dollar sign bags. So what can we do to make sure that they get paid? And usually the committee is like, oh, yeah, that makes sense, and it's unfortunate this happened, so let's go ahead and reverse. So that is the amount of control we do have. What amount of control do we have on the process? Daily. That is entirely handled by university administration. And for example, why do we have a paper process and not an electronic process? It's because there is a concern of fraud, right? And it is university. So we, the executive did take the lead on this and had a conversation with Vijay, the dean of students, and then I think it's brought up that we are finally going to transition to a electronic reimbursement process, but as all things probably will take time. And I wouldn't be able to do that. But that's, so yeah, so what input do we have? We have the ability to ask for changes to the reimbursement processes and the ability to say okay in case the reimbursement process fails. But if the organization was not registered, the organization did something that wasn't within that purview,
so I still have a few people left, Tyler, Ariana, Manisha, and then Matt again, but we are 15 minutes behind in time. So unless you have something very important you have to ask now, can I ask you to email Deja or talk to him afterwards? Okay, thank you so much.
Motion to remove the vision breakouts from the agenda. They should have been on in the first place. I forgot to do that earlier.
Okay. Any seconds? And a dissent to removing the vision breakout? Seeing none, we are removing the vision breakout. And next in the agenda, we have comment updates. And Zach?
Rita and some other folks went up to Syracuse for NAGPS this last weekend. If you have any questions about that, go see Rena, and she can also contact some of the other folks. Other than that, no updates.
What's NAGPS?
National Association for Graduate and Professional Students. Operations?
We'll have another meeting in the near future.
Thank you. Communications?
No major updates.
Appropriations?
We're going to meet this Friday, Man 100, 3:30 on Friday.
Finance?
Oh, yeah.
Student advocacy?
Yeah, we got a meeting with Pat Wynn, he's the director of Campus Life Enterprise Services.
Diversity and internet, sorry? When is this meeting? Yeah. Can you announce it?
Oh, yeah. So our committee is meeting on Wednesday. And then we're going to meet with Pat on Thursday.
What time? Location?
Okay, yeah. So, meeting on Wednesday is going to be from 2:30 to 4, and we are 14. And then the meeting with Pat Light is 4:15, 5. I can't remember the exact number, but you can email me.
Please email them for more details. Is that it? Diversity and International Students Committee. I don't think Eugene is here, so we'll skip that for now. Programming?
No updates.
Faculty awards?
No updates.
General committee?
Also no updates.
Consensual Relationship Task Force, I don't think Anna is here today. So grad school.
So very quickly, if you have been looking at the House of Representatives new tax proposal and you've delved into that and you have concerns that your tuition will now become taxable, which could be a $6,000 to $10,000 hit. At 3:30 this afternoon, we got information from legal counsel's office that because the university follows section 117A in determining the taxability of tuition that you get paid for you by the university, that the new tax proposal should not affect you. We don't follow 117D, so ignore that. Some schools might, we don't. And there should be an announcement tonight in the graduate announcements that explains more about this, maybe even more clearly than I have. And quickly, number two, if there is a meeting in 2 weeks, which is Thanksgiving week, Monday night, it's a week after Thanksgiving?
Yeah, it's the week after Thanksgiving. Yeah.
Oh,
we have one next week, and then on the 27th.
Okay, we make this announcement without the specificity of when. We do not have an active graduate grievance review board case, but in the event that we should this year, I'm going to offer to meet maybe at 5 o'clock one day. I'll bring appetizers before your meal with anybody who wants to just talk to them and learn more about what the graduate grievance review board does and what the grievance policy is. Or you can email me, or you can suggest another time, maybe over lunch or dinner one evening, and I'll meet with anybody who wants to talk more about that, to learn more about it. And your email is Jan, J-A-N dot Allen, A-L-L-E-N.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So next, we have open forums. Seeing no raising of hands or placards, we'll move on to the GPSA appropriations initial SAF recommendations.
Hello, everyone. So we are going to have, thank you. We're going to have day two of what we did last Monday. So we're going to be following the same process. So the first vote is going to be whether or not we accept the funding recommendation that the Appropriations Committee has developed. This requires majority approval. If this fails, then we hold vote two. And that's a vote to eliminate all funding for the organization for this Myron cycle. And this step requires a two-thirds majority approval. If that vote fails, then it comes back to appropriations for us to consider. And we'll present that in November next week. There will be one sort of wonky pilot group that we talk about, that'll be orientation. That's the first one. And that's the reason. So the way that we're going to do this process is the same way. So we're going to have the vote to accept $0 as the funding, and then if that passes or fails, we will then go to the second vote, which will require a two-thirds to eliminate funding. I'm willing to take. There's not clear guidance for how we approach this situation.
So let's just open the floor for formal discussion on this specific recommendation, $0 per student for orientation.
Does this mean that they will not automatically be in the bilingual funding cycle at all, consistently, or do we have to do this every year?
So they could reapply for next cycle, but this would just be for 2018-2020. They would not be receiving funds.
Alex?
Can you give like a 30-second overview of why we're not funding them at all?
For sure.
That don't feel like reading.
Yeah, I was going to say it is in the packet, so I encourage you to read it. So it essentially boils down to a few reasons. One is that basically at no other institution are graduate professional students paying for their own orientation events. When we talk with the representatives for the orientation program board, they suggested that they weren't strapped for cash and that any decrease in funding could be made up within the grad school itself. And then they really emphasize the fact, they really emphasize the fact that what is most meaningful to the group is having active feedback and ideas being generated from continuing students so that orientation events in general can be the best for incoming students. And then the fourth thing is that in 2016, the graduate school delegated responsibilities for professional student orientations to the professional schools.
Sorry, this is probably just a stupid question, but this vote is a tautology, right? Like,
regardless of how we vote. Like, I don't know why we're voting.
So, so essentially, if there are enough people within this room that disagree with this, you would vote to reject this. And then once we have a vote to eliminate funding completely, if that failed, then it would come back to us, and then you could reconsider.
Motion to call the question?
Second.
And it is time to call in the question. Seeing none, voting members, those in favor for this specific recommendation, please raise your flag cards.
Probably you
can't. So the vote, opposed. Those opposed, abstaining. So with a vote of 15-0-3, the recommendation passes. And next we have.
So because procedurally, let's talk about this for a second. So because we just approved zero funding, are we in the room okay with accepting that we have we funded this group and they will not appear in the final student activity resolution? Yes.
For information?
Yes.
Was that vote a two-thirds majority?
That is my next question. It is?
Yes.
It's a two-thirds majority.
Yes, it is. So we have 18 student members, 15 is,
majority. Okay, and then now we're back to normal for all these members. So the Appropriations Committee is recommending $2.22 for the graduate specialist student program.
So I'll open the floor for formal discussion on this specific recommendation, $2.22 per student for the graduate professional student programming board.
Motion to call the question.
Okay. And consent to call in question. Seeing none, voting members, those in favor of this specific recommendation, please raise your flag. Those opposed, abstaining, with a vote of 16-0-2, the recommendation passes.
The next up is the International Students Union. The Appropriations Committee is recommending $1.46 per student.
I'm opening the floor for formal discussion on this specific recommendation, $1.46 per student for International Students Union.
Did you get any feedback at all from ISU regarding the decrease in allocation?
So the only feedback that we received from ISU was questioning why the committee had recommended what we had in light of their application materials and what was in their hand. And so at the time we communicated to them the reasons for why we recommended this amount, and they didn't respond to my question if they wanted to.
Do you think that they're actually making strides to include grad students because depression and hunger are not?
So I would say that it is for an organization which at most has two graduate students in it, graduate professional students in it, they have historically had a significant challenge in trying to access our population. And I think that's represented in the kinds of events and advocacy events that they're holding. Part of the funding recommendation that we're putting out and what we communicated to them is that this is a 10% decrease from what we gave them last cycle. And to try and address that question, which is, are they actually serving us and the needs of our community, that we would have an active liaison working with them. That's something that we hope for a number of groups, but that would hopefully address that problem.
Alicia?
Have they indicated at all whether or not this will impact the amount of funding they give to graduate and professional student organizations? Because there are student orgs that go to ISU funding.
So, Jack, I don't know if you remember these numbers. With a 10% decrease in their budget packet, their application materials, it was a very insignificant decrease. Something like 5% less funds would be presented there, and the number of student groups that were accessing this was, I think, 5 groups. So it, that didn't necessarily seem to be an issue that would become a problem.
Elena?
Oh, I can say, Alex, to your point, it's not like official, but at one of the recent student assembly meetings I was at, the ISU mentioned that they're working with graduate professional students to put them on specific advocacy teams for things. They didn't say who they were, and I didn't get a chance to ask them, but they reported it to us.
It's something.
Matt?
In terms of, I know we also in the information committee, we're looking at alternative ways because there was concern when we were discussing this that this money might inadvertently be spilling into subsidizing undergrads because they have this house and they have 2 grad professional student members out of a full membership, I think about 90. I mean, they have extensive membership, so we are such a small minority. And I mean, their events are great. I was an undergrad grad, I've gone to a bunch of them. And I, in fact, this really don't reach out to grad students. It doesn't look like they really listen to a lot of the recommendations of the committee in the past years, which is why it says, since you know, follow the recommendation, there would be requirements placed on the money. There needs to be some form of accountability, otherwise what we write in the appendix might as well be nothing because then we're not going to report.
So yeah, I mean, okay. So part one, and just wanted to get the idea of like what how the preparations committee went on this. Is that how do we feel about ISU mostly co-sponsoring events and not actually hosting any of them itself, in a way acting sort of like a intermediary between the GPSA funds and events. Part two, that's what I'm saying. So, if there are organizations which, registered organizations, which are getting this money through the ISU, why have intermediary? Why can't we just do that directly through mechanisms of funding that we have? But why even have this particular item?
So to address your first point, this was something that members of the committee found particularly problematic was that in the obligations document, right, it does say de-emphasize your funding role and re-emphasize how much advocacy work you're doing. It seems like that wasn't taken seriously or there were no actionable steps.
Yeah, for the
So I think the members of the committee addressed and acknowledged that that is a problem, mm-hmm. and that's why we are giving them a decrease. At the same time, I think a lot of us are hoping that we can try and address this more through the obligations document. We're having a much more thorough tracking system so that the next appropriations committee, if this comes up again, will have very clear documentation of what happened this cycle and last cycle as well. And we hope that if there's genuine intent to try to host programs that are meaningful to our population, that a liaison would enable that. But the ultimate root of the problem that you're getting at, it continues to be a problem.
Okay. So the second part, like, if we are really worried about, sorry, I already said about this to be myself. If really the reason we have, if the ISU is co-sponsoring other events, and the fear is that, oh, that co-sponsorship might not go away, those groups might not be getting money. What groups are those, and can we just fund them directly instead of going through it?
Does someone from the committee want to address this question? Matt.
I mean, it's the teacher's point. I mean, their projections, they're not money, they're picking up the co-sponsorship is set to, I think, double, or they plan to double it with a lot of money from the essay. But, and actually, to your point, the reason we're looking at alternative ways, there was concern expressing, to be fair, I was going to say that we're just funding, you're concerned, if we're just, as you're having them fund a co-sponsor work, why don't we do it ourselves? I think in terms of that is something that the committee is looking at long term in terms of a solution, in terms of, okay, does that become GPCI under the FC or does it go somewhere else? Because the concern that I raised was most graduate students have no clue this is a source of potential funding. So my concern was, okay, if it turns into a, if you know the funding is here, you can get it. Good luck finding it if you're concerned. I think in the short term, it just, they were in the concern that when I raised this was brought forward, was not enough time to really restructure. I mean, I was even looking at, is there a potential that we could put ISU on the FC for their own events and take their co-sponsorships and their funding and bring that back under the FC, but that's a much bigger project that will take leases you're going to consider. I think realistically, it's a timing issue.
Yeah. So.
Manisha?
Yeah, I would say that the AC looked at an alternative to defunding ISU and allocating that money elsewhere, specifically to fund student orgs that were hosting events for underrepresented students or the sort of groups, but it just seemed like it had been a little too late in the cycle and we weren't going to be able to like actually get the details of that sort of a funding change done in time. So we ended up voting against fully defunding ISU. I mean, I didn't vote, sorry, I'm an executive member on the committee, so, but like we voted against that and instead stuck with this.
Just one, so can I then make a request to include a path forward if ISU does not follow through its obligations so that there is, you know, next time?
I think there's interest among probably all the committee members. Yes, have a very clear path.
Amanda?
Just to answer your question about which grad organization uses ISU, pretty much the entirety of the groups that fall under the umbrella of the OASC Leadership Council or the ISU Leadership Council.
So the disc.
Well, that's just on the title. Okay. Any questions? Motion to call a question?
Okay.
Is there consent to calling a question? Seeing none, voting members, those in favor of this recommendation, please raise your flag. Those opposed? Abstaining? So with a vote of 13-0-5, the recommendation passes.
Great. And for the final ballot application, we'll be voting on three. So, Cornell Cinema, the Appropriations Committee is recommending $11.
I'm putting the floor for this specific recommendation, $11 per student for Cornell Cinema.
I have a quick question for the audience. With a show of hands, how many of you received the statement that members of the Appropriations emailed out this morning? Okay, and then maybe the reps, maybe some others of you got it, but just didn't read it. Okay, for those of you who didn't get it or haven't had a chance to read it, it is in the packet material.
Alex?
So
I
got the Alex? My question, unfortunately, ties back into the LPGRO, which is the student assembly's decision, like, input on their funding situation. So if the student assembly passes their thing to defund and the administration doesn't come up with the money, all right, is the CINLA still going to exist and therefore? Because I guess ultimately, like, shouldn't we be putting the money if it's not going to exist?
So I would like to address that question in two ways. One of those ways is, if it's all right, I'd like to hand that question off to one of the representatives from Cornell Cinema. So the first thing that I would say is that if in the event we were funding an organization and that organization ceased to exist, then presumably the next semester that money would no longer be allocated, or the next year that money would. So if it's a question of sort of money going to a ghost organization that doesn't exist anymore, I don't think that probably exists. But as to the sort of nature of the question, which is what happens, does someone from Cornell Center want to speak to that? You can say no if you don't want to.
That's a reasonable question. I'm Mary. I'm the director of Cornell Cinema. Well, if the SA completely cuts our funding, which they may, they'll be voting on that this Thursday, we certainly hope the university will do something, whether they can replace all of that funding, we just don't know. So it's a big question mark, actually. I've started having discussions with university administrators basically back in the spring, and we have begun to sort of work on a proposal to the provost to basically switch Cornell Cinema over to funding from the university to replace the funding we get, certainly from the undergraduate fee, and ideally, ultimately, from the graduate fee as well. That's our goal. And I feel like we've made some positive steps. I think there are some things happening that indicate that we might see some support from the university. The hope would be that if nothing else, they could give us something that would be enough to sustain a level of activity, perhaps not the same level of activity, while, you know, if they say they can't come up with that funding, there are potentially ways that we might work with development. We have a lot of Cornell alums who are very devoted to the organization. And so even if the university might say, there's no funding currently here, development is a path we might take. And there are arts consultants that are currently putting together a report for the president and the provost based on having visited the university back in the spring, to create a report on the arts in general at Cornell. And that report, we've been told, is supposed to be issued at the end of this semester in December. We're hoping that it will address the situation with Cornell Cinema. Once again, these are all things that we're going to take a bit more time, and that's why we had proposed this 2 years. Obviously, we really hope to get the funding from the graduate students. It's just so hard to say what we would do with this, you know, this very drastic cut that the SA is proposing. I'm thinking that some amount might come to sustain us for at least some period of time while we pursue other avenues. I don't know whether that really helps much.
It's about the extent of money.
We don't know. I don't know whether there's, you guys want to add
anything. I mean, it's a really unprecedented possibility. The university budgeting cycle begins in February, and like trying to find $150,000 in 3 months is, I don't know where, if anybody knows where that is, I'd love to poke around, but yeah, so we could probably hobble along for a little bit with you know, like trying to reconcile and gather some funds. But anything that we do will take significant time and investment from us, and, you know, would ultimately be somewhat detrimental to the program itself.
So I guess the summarize the program from that state. They're changing a variety of things, reduced screen rates, reduced number of days of screening. You might not be able to outreach if any group will be kind of like the Cornell Center.
Next, I have
Max.
Thank you
for talking to me. Thank you for having me here. In this case, the way that you do this thing is what I support that. How do you transfer the community? How to step into this? I think we all agree that there's the current funding model can be a community very large chunk of the funding is even necessarily sustainable. I think the compromise that our committee reached in terms of fund them up to 11,000 cycle, and then as create a plan to draw down off the fee over the next 2 or 3 cycles, will they have time to update the funding? I think that's the sustainable way forward. I think that's sort of compromise in terms of just because their educational mission is something that is incredibly valuable, but something that I don't think necessarily is activity just because in terms of the way their cost structure runs, it looks more like an academic department, which is absolutely fine because they provide incredible value in the area. But the SA clearly is taking this pass on this case. I think our plan of giving them the money and then stepping them down and that's in the coming years is a sustainable way forward, and it's a piece of time for them.
I would just like to say that we so appreciate the work that the appropriations committee did, and it's been a sheer pleasure working with you and the thoughtfulness with which you have done your work and the questions that you've asked. It's made it possible for us to share the information you needed and this very reasonable recommendation, which we are so appreciative of, because we're basically, you really are just asking for time, because everything that Matt just said we see too that it's really time for the university to recognize the fully recognize the educational value of what we do and to help us come up with a new financial model. And we think, you know, that our idea about, you know, slowly divesting and your agreement that we do that and work together for that mutually beneficial goal. I just can't tell you how much we appreciate the way you've handled everything. So thanks so much.
Motion to call the question.
Any dissent? dissent. Okay. Any dissent on question? Seeing none, voting members in favor of this recommendation, please raise your placards. Opposed? Abstaining? So with a vote of 15-0-3, the recommendation passes.
Good job, everyone. Great. So we have a few next steps in this process. Because we didn't reject any of the initial recommendations, the appropriations committee will still meet, but this component here we won't necessarily have to address. But then at the November 13th meeting, which is next Monday, so we'll have the final student activity fee resolution. This will include the GPSA FC, which Tasia chairs right now, and the mandatory 35%. And then we will require a two-thirds majority of all seated members. So we have 18 seated members. So two-thirds of that amount is what we need in order to pass this. Once we pass this, then that's the student activity fee for 2018-2020. We've done our jobs. Lots of questions. Okay.
Okay, I have Manisha and then Zenda and
so if you are a voting member and you are not going to be able to attend the next meeting, you need to tell me as soon as possible, because if we don't have that two-thirds majority, even if we have enough to make quorum, if we don't have two-thirds majority, we can't act on this resolution. If you're not going to be able to make it, you have to tell me quickly, so if we need to, we can move it to the 27th. But hopefully that did not happen. Yeah, Jordan.
Linda?
So given we're running early and have 15 people here right now and there's no drafting that needs to happen, how impossible would it be for us to do this now?
Not possible.
Not possible.
We are fully unprepared for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Jesse?
Only because we have so much time, I just wanted to say that we voted on in terms of next, because I see next steps up. Next steps for the assembly as a whole would be to do as we did already a couple of years ago, pass another resolution and maybe make another statement to the university that we expect that Cornell University does fund Cornell Synod, because the idea that there is not money around like at a private Ivy League university for Cornell Cinema is absurd. How many dean salaries, administrator salaries do we go through to find it? But so that is something that in terms of next steps, that's not only an appropriations committee, that's on us as a whole body. So let's get on that and let's be like, this is unacceptable to fund this damn cinema. So again, I'll say again, because we did a resolution like that already in the past. Let's do it again. Yeah, done.
That's a critical part. So this, the $11 that was for Cornell Center that we just voted on, this is part of the larger strategy, which is described in the packet, but then also in the statement that we've addressed. And one of those steps is the GPSA as a whole, with the AC sort of helping to guide some of the conversation, should be sort of leading, I don't know what the right word is, but doing everything that it can to help Cornell Cinema to financially diversify and engage in this process of gradually divesting from the student activity.
Okay.
That's a great question. Yeah, that sounds good.
Manisha, I forgot to say something during open forum, so I'm sorry, am I allowed to say it now?
Yeah, sure. Yes.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
As a reminder, the Scheinman Institute on Conflict Resolution are having forums to talk about the presidential task force nomination process. And this Wednesday, November 8th, from 5 to 6 p.m., in room 423 in King Shaw Hall, they're talking specifically about nominations for graduate professional students. I cannot emphasize enough how much we should go, if we can, to learn not only what their plan is, but also hear from other student leaders what they want that nomination process to look like.
Quick follow-up on that. If you can't go to that, because I know we all have very busy schedules, there is a form in your email. People will read the input to that form. Please send things to that form about how you want this process to go, because I know we talked a lot about that in this assembly. It would be a shame of just not making that meeting by
Tyler.
So really quickly, I don't know what sort of who is in the audience. I know that it's a lot of voting members, but sort of a critical thing that the GPSA does or should be doing is to fill its external committee positions. Alex is heading up this charge, but for any of the byline organizations that you thought like, hey, that's a cool thing, or their mission, I agree with, please come talk to Alex or myself, because these liaison positions that sort of communicate between the two organizations are really critical to making sure that this process is smooth every 2 years. So some of that grunt work was done just by the Appropriations Committee this past year, but it would be really great if we could get impassioned individuals to do this and then to sort of take a larger part in the process.
Okay. Any other last comments? I would entertain a motion to adjourn. Jesse, is that a motion to adjourn? Oh, sorry. Oh, yes, Dale.
I just want to say on the actual students that we do any questions, whether about the Synod or anything else, but how this Thursday is most important, you're more than welcome to ask me or yell at me. And I can also tell you some funding cycles are a little different than the GPS that does it, but I can also clarify how the process works.
Okay, thank you.
Motion to adjourn.
Okay, second. Any dissent to adjourning now? Say none. Meeting is adjourned.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.